Be saved?
Yeah.
Good to be in church?
Yeah.
Good to know you're getting ready to get tomorrow. Hey, it's always good to be saved, guys. Always good to be in church. It has been refreshing. You know, if you take a vacation, it should be refreshing to your body and to your spirit. And I've actually had people say this. They're now deceased. But they had said, oh, man, evangelism, that's like being on vacation all year long. And they now know where Jimmy Hoffa is. But and you can't be in a meeting, you can't be in the ministry and be physically, I say it this way, you can't do your job and do nothing, unless, you know, you happen to be in Congress. But I'll give you, like, we fly out tomorrow, Tuesday, my pastor, if you can pray for somebody, pray for Pastor DeMichael. For the last 18 years, he has fought leukemia. He has to go down to Texas tomorrow and have some tests, so he texted me. We fly back tomorrow. Tuesday, I'll teach for him in the Institute at Treasure Valley. Wednesday, I'll preach for him. Thursday, I'll teach for me. And Friday, we'll take off for another meeting, do another Friday through Sunday, and on and on. So it's not it's not physically restful. But I'll tell you something. Being with you folks has been spiritually restful. It's been refreshing. It really has. And so. So I just want to let you know it's really been a blessing. I had a kind of a surprise blessing. I like cars, you know. And I'm talking about real cars, you know, 8 cylinders in a V, driving the rear wheels. And I got a V6 minivan. Well, you know, I'd heard they couldn't even get rubber. But your pastor let me use a minivan. And I found that if you put it in neutral and, like, put the gas to the floor and hold it for about 10 seconds, then drop it into drive, it'll get rubber. I know it only did that about 3 times. Now the transmission just makes this funny hissing sound. But up to that point, it was a lot of fun. It really was. So your pastor may be borrowing a car here in the next few days. Well, let me just tell you what's back on the book table. I want to give you our guarantee. I don't ever think I remembered to do this, but because I want you to know, if you get anything whatsoever off of our book table, my book table back there, and you are not 100% satisfied, tough. You think this is Walmart? I tell them, my name's Sam, but it ain't Walton, okay? In fact, if you get something off my table and you're not satisfied, take it back to Walmart. They will take anything. If we get low on cash, I take some of my books back to Walmart. You know, I said that one day as a joke, and a guy came up after church and he said, you know where I work? I said, where? He said, Walmart. He said, you know what I do? I said, what? He said, I take in return. And he said, exactly what you said is true. He said, the other day we got like a mixer or something that had been returned, and he said, I looked at the box, and the price tag said Kmart. They bought a Kmart, took it back to Walmart. Anyway, first off, I have to remind you, if you have a book back on the table that you paid for, and have to pick it up, you'll want to do that. Kathy is going to be packing those books up shortly. They'll be then sent on to a future meeting. If you paid for a book and signed up on that piece of paper, can't believe you fell for that one. Anyway, those are back there. You guys are familiar with these. This is Series 12. It's aimed at the 12th grade. We have Series 11, Series 12. For homeschoolers, also for adults that haven't been through a Bible Institute, want to get more on the history of their Bible. I was telling somebody this morning, we just preached in where? Preached in New Guinea, and I had an overnight in Sydney, and I had a meeting with our Pacific representative for Daystar Publishing, and these are now available in the Pacific. We had them printed over there, a little different format. These are 12 lessons. Those are 4 per three spiral bound things, but those are to inoculate your children. I told you I am in King James Bible believing churches every week. I cannot tell you how many times this burns me. I come into a church and it's either a brokenhearted pastor or brokenhearted parent says, we sent our son or our daughter to a quote unquote King James Bible believing Bible college. And the first thing they heard was, Easter doesn't belong there, King James homosexual, and they came back, and I've had them say this, they broke fellowship with the pastor, with the family, called them heretics, and left. After going, and you're, whoa, well, I'll call the guy and ask him myself, and he'll tell you exactly what you want to hear, and after he hangs up, he'll say, we'll straighten that kid out when they get there. So I figured, well, why should we have to re-evangelize our own children? Why don't we inoculate them? And so this is for, basically, it's aimed at grades 11 and 12. so that your kids have the answers before they go. And the testimonies have been fantastic. I was in California not long ago, and a pastor's daughter took these in the 11th and 12th grade, and she said, I went to a Bible college, and here's what she said. My professor even attacked the King James Bible with the very questions you said he would say in here. And she said, I had it. She said, I had it. Had the answers right there. I got a young man. You know, some of you have watched you, especially you darlings and all, you know. I've watched you in the pastor's children. I watched you born, grow up. And there's a church back in Ohio. This young man was preaching when he was born and watched him grow up. And in 10th and, or 11th and 12th grade, he took these and got a appointment to the Air Force Academy. And he called his mom about 2 weeks later. And he said, Mom, he said, I just spent a couple of nights, we were out on bivouac with 14 guys in a tent, and we got talking about the Bible. Now, let me give you a lost man's logic, okay? Here's what 14 lost men said about the Bible. If God really wrote the Bible, there'd only be one, and not so many. See, lost man's got good sense. You got to be saved to be stupid. And he said, Mom, he said, for the next 2 hours and 45 minutes, I taught them what I learned here. I had one young pastor's young daughter. She's 16. Took him a little bit early, and she was home alone. A couple of JWs knocked on the door, and so she said something about their Bible, and they attacked the King James Bible. And here's what she told her dad later. She said, Dad, right there, it's called Valiant for the Truth. She said, right there, my Valiant kicked in, and just overwhelmed them and sent them running. So if you haven't been through Bible Institute, this may help you. It will help you with homeschooling. It does not hurt to learn. Do you know what a scholar is? You say, oh, that's one of those very, very smart people. No, just a student. That's all it means. Scholar is a student. I am a scholar. Oh, you think you're so... No, I am always, always learning. Give me this always. Don't quote me. Always learning and never coming, getting in and out. I'm telling you, I am always trying to learn. And you should always be learning something about this book. So those are back there. Now, if you're at the other end, yeah, but I want to do this. I want to do the King James books. If you ever, do you ever put books on a bookshelf with no bookends? They fall over. I wanted to do the bookend books, which would be the easiest King James book and one of the most difficult. And so I'm working on the most difficult. I've been doing it for 10 years. And that is a catalog of the, I think it's 5,809, I don't care what you read and where you read it. Number, I think it's 5,809 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. Been working over 10 years, and that's it's quite a work. I'm trying to get it done. I just about got the text done. I got all the files done for the manuscripts. So that would be the heavy end. And then the light end is this, and that is called The Time When There Was No Bible. I call this Baby's First King James Book. Okay? That is a four-color kids' book on the history of the Bible. Now, somebody said, oh, why do we have to teach children about the King James Bible? Well, let me tell you a couple of reasons. Number one, before there were public schools, before there were Christian schools, do you know where children got their education? On their mother's lap. Mom, why don't we bring it back to your lap and give it to them there? Because it used to be this way in the secular world. A kid was going from high school to college, and during that 3 months, this was years ago, somebody'd say, hey, when you get into college, don't get on drugs. Now you got to catch a kid going from the sixth grade to the seventh grade and tell them that. Well, it used to be in the Christian realm, going from homeschooling or Christian schooling, going to a Bible college, somebody would get up against some kid and say, when you get to Bible college, don't let them take your Bible away. Now they're losing it in their homeschooling. So why don't we give it to them on their mother's lap? So this is simply a four-color history of the King James Bible. I believe this. I believe if you read this to your children, you will learn something about your King James Bible. I also get this. Maybe there's somebody in here that this applies to. I get brokenhearted grandparents. And I hope it doesn't happen to anybody here. But brokenhearted grandparents say, we brought our son or our daughter up in this church knowing where the Word of God is. Now they go to a modern church, reuse a modern version, and our grandchildren are not hearing the truth about the Bible. And so here's what I recommend, folks. Get the book, invite the grandkids over, and corrupt them. Okay? That's what you do. So that is it. Now, when I did this, I wanted to get the simplest book I possibly could. And when I sent the drafts, my drawings to the graphics lady, she sent me the roughs back in a pen and ink form, and I looked at them and I thought, wow, what is simpler than a coloring book? Now, I want to ask you a question. I told you, I used to be that I did not like to read. Now I like to read. How many of you also just really like to read? Let me see your hands. Okay, you who did not raise your hands. Something for you. And that is the same book in a different format. You know, I was telling you about James White, the guy down in Phoenix who hates the idea that God might have a perfect Bible. You know, I want him to get straight down the book. You know I'm sincere about that. And he might have to read something to get straight down. You say, oh, you're not going to send him that coloring book. No, I am not. I am not going to send him that coloring book. I already did. And I sent him the crayons because I think that's only fair. And so I sent him the crayons and the coloring book, and I said, James, I wanted something kind of on your level to get you straightened out. And I said, now remember, James, the two most important things, stay within the lines. Don't eat the crayons. So those are back there. This is one of the most recent publications. I did not write this. If you are familiar with Mike and Peg Walski, they're missionaries to Poland, and their son Toby is a assistant pastor in Pennsylvania. This is called Rightly Defining the Words of Truth, and it is just talking about some of a definition of some of the words in your King James Bible. I will tell you this, you don't have to worry about Toby. You're not going to get thrown a curve, you know, thinking you're getting a Bible believer and not really have it. That book may be interesting to you, maybe a help. This one, you guys understand, I have the understandable history of the Bible, and some people don't like to read, or some people have a lot of time driving. That we have three books now that are in audiobook form. The Living with Pain, and babe, do we have a Living with Pain audio back there? Okay, you can get it. We have the Living with Pain book, and then we have Living with Pain in audio form. Is Our English Bible Inspired? And also in audio. And then I have the Understandable History, and then this is the Understandable History audio. It is, I don't know how many CDs, but if you do a lot of driving and you don't want to, you know, you don't have to read, that may be a help to you, so that is back there. And the other idiot in Phoenix is a guy named Stephen Anderson, and he's the one that wants to go through tribulation, and I'm the one that wants him to. But several years ago, I exposed the errors of his teaching, and then he took my salvation away from me and told everybody I can't even be saved. To which I figure if he didn't have nail holes in his hands, I don't really worry about what he says anyway. But you know, guys, let me show you something. My outlines, are that size. That little outline is about a half of a sheet of paper like that. That is 12 sheets of scripture, reference after reference after reference, showing where this man is in error, where he is dishonest, and I would say something. He is everywhere because of the internet. I was just over in New Guinea. He is in New Guinea. I'm in Australia. He is in Australia. When I did this, I heard from China and from Australia and from England, just those three, and saying thanks for exposing what's wrong with him. So, and what he is doing, even as I speak, he is sending people into churches like this. When you know what they do? They come in innocent, and they go, can we go soul winning with you? Well, who doesn't want somebody to go soul winning with you? This guy is so nuts that 7 times he had the police called on him going door to door. Because he's nuts. He's nuts. And he sends his people into churches, and then he gets the weak sheep and sends them all to Phoenix to his church. So those things are back there, and the book table will be up for a few minutes. Kathy will be packing it up. But if you got books back there that you paid for, pick them up. If you didn't pay for any of them, just yell, look, Elvis, and then grab a book and run out the door, and that will still be working. All right, It has been good. It has been good to be here. 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2, very unique book in the Bible, like no other book in the Bible. 2 Timothy. Now, I think you'll understand what I'm saying when I say this. From the moment you got saved, I don't know when you got saved. For me, it was about 47 years ago. All good, guys. It's been all good. Hadn't it been good to be saved? And since you got saved, since I got saved, we have and you have been spiritually prepared for death, right? Okay. I have a different sermon. Hang on a second. Are you ready to die? Because I'm about to kill you, okay? Well, let me give you an example. When we were down in Pensacola in Bible college, Kathy and two other ladies down there, I had a trio, and about a couple of years ago, maybe 5 years ago, you know, we kept touch with those, the three ladies kept in touch with each other. And about 5 years ago, one of those three was just walking down the hallway with her husband in their home, and she just kind of sighed and fell to the floor, and she was dead before she hit the ground. Now, she didn't have time to take care of business with God about getting saved, correct? But it was no problem, because from the day she got saved, she was ready for that moment. You understand what I'm talking about? I heard of a preacher one time. He was preaching, and that's what he said. He was preaching, and he said, "Are you ready?" And as he said that, he began to fall. And he said, "Are you ready? Are you ready?" And boom, before he hit the ground, he was dead. But that's okay, because from the moment he got saved, he was spiritually prepared for that. If you thought this, you know, I will fly tomorrow, and I get people ask me some stupid questions. Like I've had people say this: "When you get on a plane, do you ever think it's going to crash?" I said, "Well, no. If I thought it was going to crash, I wouldn't get on it. I'd give the ticket to my mother-in-law." I mean, you know. And but there have been times, you know, you get up an airplane, they drop a few thousand feet, and you always say this: you ought to learn something new about yourself every day. And I had a plane that dropped several thousand feet. I learned two new things about myself that day. I did not know I could hit a note that high and hold it that long. But but really, here's what it is. You know, when that thing, if the engine shut off and it goes down, it takes about 4 or 5 minutes before it hits the ground, which has got to be a very frantic several minutes. So if that happens, that's okay. It may be terrifying, but since you got saved, been spiritually prepared, correct? But that doesn't mean that you're psychologically prepared. By that, I mean this. We had a lady many years ago that worked for us at Daystar Publishing. I have to add that because there's a Daystar kind of a want to name and claim it type deals. But Daystar Publishing, she worked for us, and she was fine and healthy, and she went to the doctor, and the doctor examined her, and he said, I can't remember what kind of cancer she had, but he said, "You have got 60 days. 60 days to the day she died. Now, you go to a doctor, and let's face it, there are some things that when you hear about it, you just figure I'm a goner. Some years ago, about 5 or 6, I can't remember which, I got cancer. And I went to this doctor, you know, and I had cancer right here. And he said, "Well, it's probably basal cell cancer, nothing big." And he said he took a little chunk out, like a football standing on end. So it was high, pointed at 12 o'clock, pointed at 6 o'clock. So he takes this cancer out, and it's like everything else we do. I mean, we come into town, and we're gone in 4 days. So, boom, he cuts on me, and off I go. And he was in Ohio, and about 2 days later, after he sent this thing to the lab, I get a phone call from him, and he's a little antsy, and he goes, "You got to come back here." I said, "I can't come back there. So I'm 300 miles away, headed away from you, headed for a meeting." And he said, "Well, that's not basal cell cancer." And he said, "The way I cut it, I left cancer at 3 and 9 o'clock." And he said, "You've got to come back." I said, "Well, I can't come back. I've got some meetings." And so the original surgery was in April, and the second one was in June. I finally got back, and he. "I've just been fine ever since they did this. I don't have any problem." But here's the thing, guys. When somebody tells you you've got cancer, you just kind of figure, I'm cooked. Right? Yeah. I'm cooked. And I know there are people that survive it, and I'm all for it. But if somebody tells you something, you figure, man, this is it. Now, think about this. If you went to the doctor tomorrow, and your doctor said, you got 2 weeks. I know of a guy, they sent him to the hospital, and the doctor told him, he said, man, get to the hospital. You got about 2 weeks to live. 2 weeks later, boom, dead. If you went to the doctor tomorrow, and they said, you've got 2 weeks to live, I'm going to tell you what you'd do. There's somebody in this world you care about. You would contact them in some way. And you know what it's not time to do? It's not time to contact somebody that you care about, somebody that you love, somebody that you have great affection for, and say, 67 years ago, our forefathers brought forth this continent, a new nation dedicated proposition, all men are... No. No, you know what you would do? If you cared about somebody, you'd take all of the emotion and all of the love and all of the concern that you have for them, and wouldn't you try to compress it and compact it into as small and short a statement as you can so that when you're gone, they can remember what you said? Because maybe that will get them through a tough time. That is exactly where the Apostle Paul is when he writes to 2 Timothy. There's why 2 Timothy is unique in all of the epistles that the Apostle wrote is that this is the last one. If you have a Bible that has dates at the top, mine says A.D. 66. Check anything else out, brother. There's nothing. A.D. 66, A.D. 65, A.D. 63, A.D. 59. This is the last thing that the apostle wrote. He did write to a couple individuals. He wrote to Philemon and Titus. We know most of what he wrote. He wrote to churches. But he wrote two epistles to this guy, Timothy, who he loved how? Like his own son. Isn't that right? So here's where he is. At the time he writes this, he is in a jail cell in Rome. And you know what he knows? Now, I believe this. You and I, if the Lord tarries long enough, you and I are going to, we're going to spend maybe our last minutes, our last days, in a bed somewhere, in a hospital, in a nursing home, maybe your own bed. And one day, you know what you're going to hear? You're going to hear death's footsteps coming down the hall. And you're going to know that your name is at the top of his list. And I say it this way, you're going to see one more sunrise than you see sunsets. It's going to be over. And here's what Paul is doing. He knows that he is never going to see this kid again. I mean, as he is writing this, they could come by and decide today is the day we're taking his head. Correct? So here's this kid. He loves him like his son. And he knows he's never going to see him. I wonder sometimes how many things and how many tough times that Timothy had and got through that Paul kind of helped him through. Wouldn't you do that to somebody you love? If you had somebody that you cared for, that you loved, like a son or a daughter, and they were going through a tough time in their life, wouldn't you want to do something, have some part in getting them through that? But here's what the apostle knows now. I'll never see this kid again. I am going to die, but life is going to go on for him, which means tough times are going to come. And I will not be there to help him. I will not be there like I have in the past. And Paul said this, you know what I got to do? I got to take all that I feel inside me for Timothy. I got to take all of the love and all of the care and all of the compassion, and I need to compress it to as short a statement as possible. How about this, guys? What if you could compress it to one word? What if you could take all of the love you had for somebody and give it to them in one word? Now, you ought to be able to remember a word, shouldn't you? And you'd say, if I can get Timothy to remember this one word, the next time he goes through tough times and I'm not there, maybe he'll remember this word. And even though I won't be there, I'll help him get through the tough times. Now, it just so happens that if you want somebody that can say a lot with one word, this is the artist. The Apostle Paul? Is this not the guy? Look, tell me if this is true. If you're going to show somebody something about the word grace in the Bible, I don't believe you're going to show anybody anything about grace in the Bible and not end up in something that Paul wrote. Because he explained grace like no one else explained grace. How about faith? Do you know how you got saved? You say, well, I trusted the death, but no, let me tell you. I'm going to tell you how I got saved. You got saved. You put your faith in one of the craziest statements ever made. That 2,000 years ago, somebody died for somebody who hadn't even been born. Whose parents hadn't been born. Whose grandparents hadn't been born. Whose great-grandparents hadn't even been born, correct? So here's what you believe. You believe that 2,000 years ago, some guy died on a cross and that somehow his death was payment for your sins And if you just take his death and his burial and his resurrection as a payment for your sins, you have eternal life. And you put your faith in that, right? Now, I don't mean it's bad, but that's kind of crazy when you think about it. You know how crazy that is? That is like telling a 90-year-old man, look at the stars, you're going to have as many kids. And Abraham said, that is the craziest thing I ever heard, but I believe it. And so in Romans chapter 4, we didn't believe the same thing that Abraham believed, but we believed in the same crazy thing. Some statement that just didn't make any sense. And so you got saved through the faith of Abraham. So Paul, man, he'll tell us about grace, he'll tell us about faith. Is it not Paul that said, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's? Is it not Paul that said, you know what you guys need to do? You need to wrestle with principalities and powers. Didn't he say, do anything you want to do, guys, but at some point you're going to have to stand. Correct? So Paul, this is not the first time he's ever had to try to communicate some great important message with one word. But this may be the most important message he ever transmits to anybody, because he won't be there to explain it. So here he is. He is writing to Timothy. You know what we're going to do tonight? We're going to do something you always wanted to do. We're going to read somebody else's mail. Didn't Paul write an epistle to Timothy? I don't think you're in that circle. But it is now public domain, so we're going to read somebody else's mail. The reason we're going to do it is because maybe down the road you're going to have some problems. Maybe you're going to get into something. Maybe it's going to overwhelm you. And maybe this apostle, now at the time he writes this, he has been saved for 32 years. He has been preaching for 32 years. He has traveled extensively, but his life is at its end. And maybe what Paul told Timothy, Timothy, if you can get this word and hang on to it, it'll get you through it. Maybe if we can grab a hold of that word and hang on to it at our toughest time, maybe we get through something too. I'm all for it. So in this epistle, the apostle says something over and over and over and over and over again. He uses a word, I mean over and over again, hoping that it will get into Timothy's head, hoping it will get into his heart. And I'm going to give you that word from the Apostle Paul, hoping that maybe that word will get in your head and in your heart, so at your darkest moment, when you don't think you can get through it, maybe you can latch onto that word, and it'll get you through right up to death's door or the rapture. 2 Timothy chapter 2, it says this, thou therefore, my son, there it is, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus, and the things which thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men, who shall be able to teach others also. Thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. Let's bow our heads and let's talk to the Lord. Father, Lord, it really is. God, when I say it's good to be in church, it is not a cliche. It is always good to be in church. God, thank you that we could be in church tonight. There is not a thing on this planet that is greater right now than being in church. And so, God, I am just so glad. I'm glad for these people that they recognize the value of being in church. Not to come and hear me. They don't have to come and hear me. They need to be here because the lights are on, the doors are open. This is your church. Maybe they'll come tonight. Maybe tonight, God, my prayer. Get Gip out of the way. And take Paul's one word and put it in these people's hearts. That maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years, who knows, maybe 10 weeks down the road, they get into the most turbulent part of their life, and they'll grab a hold of that one word, and it will get through them as maybe it got Timothy through after Paul was long gone. God, if we can get this word in our heads and in our hearts, maybe we can just survive all the way to the end of this thing. In Jesus Christ's name we pray. Amen. Let's look at those three verses again. Thou therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And the things which thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men, who shall be able to teach others also. Thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. And there is the word. It is found in verse 3. Thou therefore endure. You are going to find in this book, Paul says, endure, 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 endure. He is trying to get this kid to get through it. Endure. Now, when I talk about endure tonight, don't misrepresent this. I'm not talking about what it says in Matthew chapter 10 and Matthew chapter 24, endure to the end and you shall be saved. No, 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 that's not what I'm talking about. But there are still some things that you have to endure. Do you ever have a root canal? Yeah, that'd be a little bit of endurance, isn't it? There are just some things in life, you know what you got to do? You just got to endure them. Is that not true? And so there's some things coming, and here's the first thing Paul said. He said, son, you've got to endure as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. Now, I read a lot of stuff about the military, and when we think about enduring as a soldier, the first thing that came to my mind, which was an error, by the way, but the first thing that came to my mind was this. This is what I see of a soldier enduring. We all see it, you know, they get hurt, they get wounded, and they just keep on persevering and keep on going. I don't know if you guys know it, but during the great Second World War, the United States territory was indeed invaded. It was shelled and invaded. A couple of years ago, we were in Oregon, just plopped down in an RV park along the Oregon coast. We're driving down the road, and there was a little sign, and I couldn't believe what the sign said. So we followed this sign, and it looked like a tombstone. It was a granite monument. Some back during World War II, a Japanese submarine surfaced off the Oregon coast and lobbed about 16 shells into the continental United States. And we're standing there, we're reading right here where one of them hit, right here on our soil. Also, the Japanese invaded Alaska during World War II. Down at the very end, 1,000 miles from Dutch Harbor, clear over here near the mainland, down the Alaskan archipelago, the last two islands are Attu and Kiska. And the Japanese invaded both of those. Now, it's volcanic, worst weather in our country, worse than... And so, they really got mad at him, apparently. But it is bad, really bad. And so the Americans, the Japanese were on Attu and on Kiska, and the first thing the Americans did is they landed on Attu. And it's all volcanic, it's all, you know, very mountainous. And these soldiers, they were trying to go up this hill, and there were machine gun nests, and the Japanese were shooting down on them and throwing grenades downhill on them. And every time the Americans would try, all they achieved was getting some more American soldiers killed. And there was one young soldier, and he just saw too many of his guys get killed. He had had enough. And this kid just grabbed all the hand grenades he could, took his M1, and started up that mountain. And they said he ran up to a machine gun nest, pulled the pin, threw in a grenade, shot the survivors, ran up to a machine gun nest, threw in another grenade, shot the survivors. Say, well, how did he do that without getting shot? He didn't do that without getting shot. He got shot, and he got shot, and he got shot. But he never stopped. And they said they watched him at like 7 different machine gun nests he had to knock out till he finally ends up on the top of this mountain and there's no place else to go. He has reached the thing. What he didn't know is that right behind him was his entire company falling to the top of that mountain. And when he got to the top and the enemy had been stopped and the Americans had taken the hill, he laid down and died. He was dead going up that hill. And so when we think of endure hardness as a good soldier, that's kind of the first thing that comes into our minds. And I don't mean to take anything away from that. But here's why I stop at this. I hate to say what I'm about to say. But have you never heard of this? Have you never heard of a somebody in some kind of a sport who played with an injury? I have heard of football players with broken ribs. I mean, isn't football, the object of football is me to hit you where? In the ribs? So here's a guy with broken ribs, and he's going to go out and play a game where they're going to hit him in the ribs, and he plays with a flak jacket, or they go out with broken wrists and broken fingers and broken arms, broken toes, and they push on. Now, I am not comparing them to a soldier. All I'm saying is that's kind of similar. And I thought about a hardness that a soldier has to endure that is different than anything anybody else has to endure, and I think I got it. You know what it is? A soldier has to endure hardness in taking a decision that does not have his best interest in mind. You know, I call the young generation. I told you, I love seeing your young people in here. You got so many of them, and they're a blessing to me. And I call their generation. I don't mean this as an insult, but I call that the "it's all about me" generation. We got a whole generation You know, they all grew up with a t-shirt that said, "It's all about me." And that's what they believe. You wouldn't think that we needed lessons in selfishness, but your television has been very good at doing it. And so, isn't this it? Go get the best. You deserve the best. You deserve hell. You don't deserve the best. You deserve the hottest. Isn't that true? But we've got a generation that all believe that they just got the best thing coming. I actually had a guy say this, not a bright kid at all. He said, "I hope America goes into a depression, an economic depression." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, I heard about that depression back in 1929, and when the country went into depression, the whole country just got together and worked together, and they were united." Well, that's true. That's true. I said, kid, I said, that generation of 1929, they went to church. If they went to a bad church, they still heard the Ten Commandments, did they not? I said, that generation believed in working. Now get this, that generation, the bad people, the bad men, would not cuss in front of a woman. Isn't that true? I think an organized criminal wouldn't say a foul word in front of a woman. Now we've got teenage girls using worse language than those guys did. I said, the generation today, if we went into a depression, this generation believes this: if you've got some food and I don't, you owe me some of yours, and me and my friends are coming to get ours. That's how we are. Because everybody believes, isn't it funny? We don't believe in this entitlement from the government philosophy. Isn't that true? But we all, Christians, we all believe entitlement from God. You don't think that the government should give everybody they could possibly want, but some of you believe that God ought to give you everything you want. And so here's what happens. You know what happens when you go into military? Not every order you're given. They don't give you an order and go, "Now, is that okay with you? You want to do that? Because if you don't want to do that, we'll get somebody else to do that for you." They don't ask your opinion. Is there anybody here who would like to charge the enemy? I saw one of the funniest interviews back in 1990 during the first Gulf War. Just the first Gulf War kicked on. They're interviewing this kid in the Army. You know, he's about 19 years old. He's got this Kevlar helmet that's like three sizes too big. He's about as big around as this mic stand. And here he looks like, and they're holding this mic up, and he goes, "I didn't join the Army to fight. I just wanted to get my college paid for." And I thought, and you will if you survive. See, just look at the bright side. But you know what the problem is, people? The problem is that we have now got a generation that they can't take anything that doesn't put them first. A soldier cannot do that. A soldier has to get an order, and he knows when he gets that order, it may be the last thing he ever hears and the last thing he ever does. And you know what he does? He rises to the occasion. He endures hardness as a good soldier, and he goes out and obeys that order and dies. You know, in all military situations, this is true. But the situation I'm going to talk to you about was the Vietnam War. And I knew a guy that was in the Army. He was in the 82nd Airborne in Vietnam. And you know, it was all jungle terrain. And what they do is when they have a patrol, you always have a guy that walks point. And so here you got you got all of your patrol strung out, in a column. But you got a guy about 50 feet out ahead of everybody, and he's walking point. Say, what's he? He's kind of like the guy with the target around his neck. He's the tripwire. The enemy shoots him first, and then everybody else goes, "Oh, they got Bill. They must be out there." That's how you know. It's not a lucrative position, okay? "We want you to be our man out in front." "Oh, they want me to be the man out in front." That's not how it goes. And because that is a fatal position, it really is, a lot of guys at walk point end up dying. So what you do is you got a squad of men, you got maybe a dozen guys, you got a company or a platoon of men, maybe 30, 35 guys. They rotate that position so that the same guy doesn't have to walk it. I mean, we're trying to be a little bit fair here, okay? And they rotate that position so that a different guy walks point on each patrol. This guy was a very zealous soldier. More zealous probably than he should have been. To the point, this guy would clean his weapon, and to see if it was sighted in, he'd just shoot at somebody. You say, "You mean the enemy?" No, he'd just shoot anybody. And here's what his platoon leader said. He said, I want you to walk point on tomorrow's patrol. So he walked point. Next day they had another patrol. He said, I want you to walk point again. And the guy kind of looked at him. And after about 3 days walking point, he said, what are you doing? He said, I want you to walk point on every patrol we take. Because if you walk point on every patrol, at some point the enemy is going to kill you and my problems with you will be over. That is what he told him. Now, can I ask you something? Is that fair? Is that fair? Is that in the great democratic tradition of America? No. It is not fair. It is not right. And it is intended to get the guy killed. And by the way, had he been killed, he'd have gone straight to hell. You know what he did instead? He didn't go over his commanding officer's head. He didn't say, you know, my lieutenant is trying to get me killed. You know, every time they went on patrol, I mean, for the last year he's in Vietnam, he went on point. He walked point. He walked point. He endured hardness as a good soldier. He did not get killed. Came back to this country. Got saved. He's in church today. But guys, you know what our problem is? We don't like any decision that God makes in our lives that doesn't end up with us being a millionaire or famous. Isn't that true? Yep. You know what you have to do? You have to endure hardness as a good soldier. The Lord is going to give you some kind of an order, and it's not going to make you a hero, and it's not going to make you a star. And it may not even help you. It may not be good for you. Good night, man. I go over to New Guinea, and I talk to people. They have had malaria so many times, it's not even funny. They got holes in their heart from it. That's not good for anybody. And how they get it? They were ordered to go there by the commanding officer. And you know what they knew? If I go over there, I'm probably going to get malaria and it may kill me. That's right. So they endured hardness as a good soldier. You know what you're going to have to learn to do? Every one of you. You know what you say? Oh, God, tell me what you want me to do. And so he does. And you say, oh, God, you got a second option? You got a plan B? No. You're going to have to endure hardness as a good soldier and go do something for God, and it is not going to make you a star, and it is not going to make you rich, and it is not going to make you famous. And it may not be good for your health, and it may not be good for anything except the Lord. But that's who we're serving. We're supposed to serve a cause greater than ourselves. And that is what's wrong with our nation today. Do we not have a nation of people and nobody in it serves a cause greater than themselves? So guys, Paul says, Tim, look, Lord, hey, who knows what God told Timothy to do? But Timothy probably had the same spirit some of you have. God, just tell me what you want me to do, I'll do it. And then God told him, he goes, you sure about this? Yeah, I'm sure about it. All right, I'll endure hardness, I'll do it. Paul told me to endure hardness as a good soldier, I'll do it. So you have to endure hardness as a good soldier. Look at chapter 3. In chapter 3 it says this, in verse 10, but thou hast fully known my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, charity, patience, persecution, afflictions, which came unto me at Antioch, at Iconium, at Lystra, what persecutions I endured. All right, guys, you may have to endure some persecution. Now, there's different kinds of persecution. Most persecution, when we think of it, we think of like national organized persecution that is aimed at Christianity. Prior to this president, we saw that monster forming in this country, did we not? And trust me, it is still in the shadows. But that is the persecution, you know, when they burnt the Christians at the stake, when the Inquisition, and they picked the Christians out and they tortured them and burned them at the stake. And that is persecution. Sometimes it is not corporate, the lost world against Christianity. Sometimes it's just some individual against you because you got a Christian testimony. And so they decide they're going to try to break you. They're going to try to destroy you. They just hate you. And so they're going to do something to you. But not even that. Sometimes persecution has nothing to do with Jesus Christ. It is just somebody doesn't like you. But here's the key to persecution. It is bad that comes your way. I take that back. It is bad that would not come your way if it were not directed at you by another human being. This is not driving down the road and your tire going flat. That's not persecution. It is coming outside and finding somebody slashed all four of them. That's persecution. You know, when I was in Bible college, I was working construction, and there was one particular guy, man, he hated me. He hated Jesus Christ. He hated the Bible. And one day at the end of a work day, I walked out, and there in my right front tire, I can still see it, sticking out of the sidewall, not on the tread, out of the sidewall at a 90-degree angle was an 8-penny finishing nail. Now, I had this Dodge Dart slant six. I think it had 4 horsepower. You couldn't go fast enough and turn the wheel for that tire to roll over and pick up a nail on the sidewall. That nail had been held there and driven in with a hammer. And I personally to this day think that's the guy. That's not fair. No, it's not. What did you do? I went and bought a tire. That's life, guys. But you know, it may not just be about Jesus Christ. Maybe you're at work and you have a chance for a promotion, but there's somebody else that wants that promotion, and they know that you're the other candidate, so they just start sabotaging your work or sabotaging your reputation. It's got nothing to do with Jesus Christ, but you get persecuted. It may be. You know, I've talked to plenty of guys, brother. They work at a job, and they open up their toolbox, and somebody's come by with a pornographic picture and slapped on the inside of their locker. And they had to tear the thing out. Or they get picked on. I had a young man in my youth department. Man, this is the most godly young guy today. He pastors in Florida, pastors a church. And one of the most godly guys. Not very meek young man. Now, he was steady, brother. He was steady. But not the, you know, tough guy type guy. And he went to public school there in Maslin. And the guy loved his mom. And he made her, all year long, he made an elaborate bookcase for her in the woodworking shop at high school. And he put this thing together and he sanded it and got all the moldings together properly. And he put sanding sealer on it, sanded that down. He put a nice finish on it, stained it all out, got it all done. He finished it on the next to the last time in shop. And so he said, I finished it. He said, I went by the last day of school and somebody had taken a screwdriver and just gouged that whole thing up. Just went through the sides of it, absolutely ruined it because they hated his Christian testimony. What's persecution? Now, we're not being persecuted, you know. A lot of people that say they're persecuted for Christianity, they're actually persecuted for stupidity. A lot of people, they go out and they try to get arrested street preaching and then go, look, I'm being persecuted for Jesus. No, you tried to get persecuted. But still, guys, somewhere along the line, and if time continues, at some point in this country, don't be surprised if it does become a corporate persecution of Christianity. I'm not for that. Some of the brethren think they don't care because, oh, I got a King James Bible. It won't happen to me. Oh, guess what, bucko? And you know what you're going to have to do? You're going to have to endure it. Well, I think God should stop it. Who cares what you think? Nobody cares what you think. Life isn't about what you think. And so you're going to have to endure persecution. Take a look at chapter 4. Look at verse 1. The Apostle Paul says this, I charge thee therefore before God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall judge the quick and the dead. There's that Texas reference again. At his appearing and his kingdom, preach the word, be instant in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with all long suffering and doctrine. Now, with the end of verse 2, in the next verse, you know what the apostle does? He prophesies about something that is going on today that was not true at his time. Isn't that what a prophecy is? Isn't a prophecy, it isn't happening right now, but it will someday? Okay? Here's what he says. For the time will come, someday in the future, when they will not endure sound doctrine. But after their own lust shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned unto fables. Hey, guys, we are in that time. You know what you need to do? You need to, at this point, endure sound doctrine. I told you this morning, I am not just a Baptist. I am an independent Baptist. But I'm not just an independent Baptist. I am a King James Bible-believing, premillennial, independent Baptist. All right? And we're right. And if you were ever going to doubt your doctrine, this might not be the best time to review it. Because there is a spirit out there. Do you know why this idiot in Phoenix has got some ground, some gaining some ground? Because there is a spirit in this world right now where you, it said they, that's you're the they don't want to endure sound doctrine. And it is in you and it is in I. I talked to a pastor friend And he said, I'm going to take Baptist off the name of my church. Now, every guy that ever wanted to take Baptist off the name of the church, it's for one of two reasons. And this guy here was his reason. He said, I'm in a little town, and having Baptist off the name, on the name, people won't stop and visit. And if I take Baptist off, I think I'll get more visitors. So he takes Baptist off the name of his church. And I was in his church about a year after that. And I said, so how's your little experiment going taking Baptist off the name? And he goes, you know something? Since I took Baptist off the name of our church, I've had more visitors this year than I have had in all of the years I passed this church. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, but you know what? None of them stay. He said, they all show up, and when they find out we're not charismatic, they just go out the back door. I said, well, it sounds like it wasn't worth it. Why don't you put Baptist back on? He did. The other reason they take Baptist off is they say this, well, I'm just tired of fighting over the name Baptist. Well, I'm going to tell you the truth. You do get tired of fighting. Oh, trust me, guys. Trust me. You get tired of fighting. The greatest soldier on the planet at some point gets weary of fighting. But there's only two things you can do when you get tired of fighting. Surrender or go get some rest and then go back to fighting. I knew a pastor, and he said, I am tired of fighting over the name Baptist, so I'm going to take the name Baptist off my church. And he did. And you know what he found out after that? He was tired of fighting over the King James Bible. He was tired of fighting then over good music standards. They was tired of fighting over dress standards. The church he pastors now contemporary, they got no standards whatsoever, and he's not the pastor of it. He's not even in the ministry, which is good. He doesn't belong in it. He should have got out before he changed his church. Say, what's the problem? Wouldn't endure sound doctrine. You know what you're going to have to do? You're going to have to endure sound doctrine. Oh, preacher, you don't have to worry about me there. I do. All right, let me show you this. You believe salvation is by grace? Death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ? Only way to get to heaven, right? Yeah, most Christians do. Except for my 81-year-old grandmother. You know, my 81-year-old grandmother, I just can't believe she'd go to hell. She could. She wouldn't hurt a fly. She wouldn't hurt a fly because she's 81. She can't hurt a fly. That's why she's, you know, like, what did she do today? Grandma, what'd you do today? Sat up. What else would you like to do? Lay back down. Hey, here's what you need to do. You need to go to your 81-year-old, sweet, loving, unsaved grandmother and take that 81 and flip it around and follow her around for a weekend when she was 18, and you'll find out why she still deserves hell when she's 81. You know what I hear? I hear this. I hear this so much. I hear people say, well, you know, our son is gay. Well, first off, he's not gay. I mean, really, you know, that's a nice word. You know what gay is? You ever watch a kid play with a puppy? That is gay. You ever watch a new calf, a newborn calf skip across a prairie or a pasture to its mother? That's gay. If you ever saw two homosexuals in action, you wouldn't say, well, aren't they gay? You'd say, that is sick. That is perverted. That is abnormal. That is queer. You say gay because your other pastor, your television, rebuked you and told you to heal to it instead of God. And I'll come up and go, well, I say Sodom. Yeah, probably you do, but probably you don't either. You just say that because you haven't got the guts to stand up for it. And I hear these mothers, and they say this. They go, well, you know, we our son is gay, but we still have him over here because we still love him. And we just want to show him the love of God. No, you don't. You don't love him. You love yourself. And you don't want to have to pay the price of standing for God. Hey, guys, you're going to have to endure sound doctrine. Do you believe in spanking? I mean, I believe in spanking. Kids! I just want to make that. I had an idiot. You know, I told you, it's one thing to be stupid, it's another to let everybody know. And I had a guy believed that he had the right to spank his wife. And I said, let me smell your breath. Let me see if you're not on something. I said, you think we can spank our wives? He goes, Jesus spanks his wife. So I told him what I will tell you, and this is the fact. I said, spanking is chastisement, correct? I said, when we receive, you and I, when we receive chastisement from our God, go ahead and check your Bible out. It's not the husband-wife relationship. It's the father-son. It doesn't say the husband chastises every wife. It says the father chastises every son. When you get spanked by God, it is not the husband spanking his bride. It is the father spanking his son. I said the chastisement, the spanking, comes from the father-son relationship. I said that husband-wife relationship is the husband goes out and dies for the wife. Why don't you try that once? And yet, you know something? I see people, they're raising kids. You know, look, we've got a generation, and they believe the same thing the world believes about spanking. Did you know this Antifa group that's trying to burn the country down? Do you know who that is? That's the generation that they told us would be better than the generation before them because they wouldn't be spanked. Man, I wish somebody spanked them. They might not have thought it was okay to set fire to buildings that don't belong to them. Guys, I'm telling you, you're going to see the time when you don't want to endure sound doctrine. In fact, I believe this. I believe you could come up with any kind of a screwy, crazy, obviously nutso doctrine, and you would get somebody to fall. Let's just say this. Let's just say tonight, let's think of something crazy. Nobody could believe it. Let's say we start believing tonight that we're going to go halfway through the tribulation. You'll get followers. I got to tell you this. I've always had this secret desire. I won't follow it. Don't worry. But you know what I've always wanted to do? I always wanted to found my own church. No, I don't mean an independent local Baptist church. No. I'm talking about like at a denomination. And it talks in the Bible about the latter growth. And I've always wanted to start the church of the latter growth. And our symbol is going to be all of the men are going to have mullet haircuts. That's the latter growth. Now, here you are laughing, okay? So you're laughing at me, right? If I started it tonight, I'll bet you a year from now, I'd have a bunch of idiots with Elvis haircuts saying we're members of the Church of Latter Growth. If I tried to start it 200 years ago, they'd go, get out of here, you're nuts. But we are now in the age when people will not endure sound doctrine. You need to endure sound doctrine. Doctrine is the rock. Doctrine is the foundation. Listen, that book says, till I come, give attendance to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. Reading the Bible, exhortation through preaching, and stick with your doctrine. That's your foundation. Look what it says in chapter 4, verse 5. But watch thou in all things endure afflictions. Now here's the difference between persecution and affliction. Persecution is trouble that you would not get unless somebody directed it to you. It's aimed at you because somebody, for some reason, doesn't like you. Affliction, that's just life, bucko. I mean, that's just going to happen. You're just going to stub your toe walking down the hall in the middle of the night, all right? You're going to sit on a chair, and a leg is going to collapse, and you're going to fall. You're going to fall down. You're going to chip your tooth. That is affliction. It happens to everybody. You understand that? You know, some people, they think that when they got saved, all of a sudden their car is going to get better mileage. They're never going to have a toothache again. Their mother-in-law is never going to visit. Nothing bad is ever going to happen. Get real, pal. There is affliction. Now, it's different for different people. Some people have chronic illness. My pastor has chronic illness. Can you imagine living every day with something in your body saying, I'm going to kill you? For 18 years, 18 years, every day when he wakes up, he's got leukemia. He says, I want to kill you. He's fighting that for 18 years. But I'm talking to somebody in here, and who knows what you got. It may not be something that would try to kill you like that, but I'll bet somebody in here has got diabetes. And I'll bet you it just tears you up, and you have problems with healing on your feet, and you have problems with emotional swings because of the diabetes and the sugar. You say, yeah, I have a problem with it. What do I do? You have to endure it. You have to endure affliction. I'm sorry. You have to endure it. People have different problems. They have physical problems. They have diseases. You have to endure it. I don't have a disease. I have pain. Some people have that. There's probably somebody, you got a back every time you stand up. Your back just makes you want to cry. That's just life. Guys, I have had a headache for 2 years, every single day. 2 years ago in October 2015, I used to get a headache for 2 or 3 months. This has been 2 years. And now I'm pretty sure. Well, in fact, I went to a doctor not long ago and had him look at it to see if he could do anything. Why do I go to doctors? They never tell me anything good. And I have some problems with my hands and my arms. And he said, he did an MRI and an X-ray. And he said, you have permanent damage to your spinal cord. The headache will never go away. We'll never do anything about the hands and the arms. And that was the good news. And then he told me that the 08 fusion is broken loose. And he wants to go back in and cut it all out and go up one level and fuse it all. And I just said, I'm not doing that. He said, well, don't get in a car wreck because an airbag will be devastating. But I deal with pain all the time. Okay, it's no big deal. I can do it. And sometimes I lay in bed and I cannot sleep. Part of the problem is because one of the vertebrae that is bad causes insomnia. But sometimes it's not insomnia. Sometimes I just hurt too bad. So what do you do? Got to endure it. You're just going to have to endure. Look, I'm telling you, understand this? I am on your side. If you have a disease, if you have a sickness, if you have an illness, and it is an affliction, I am sorry for you. I am. I have compassion. If you have a problem with pain of some sort, I am with you. I am sorry. But it's not going to go away. I get people all the time. Oh, here's what you need to do. I have had this for 44 years. You think you're going to come up with the answer now? If God wanted to get rid of it, he wouldn't have waited 4 decades, bud. So I just figure it's here. It is here for the duration. So what are you going to do? I endure it. I have one prayer. I never asked God to take the pain away. Oh, I did for decades. For decades I did. But I know it's not going away. So you know what my prayer is now? Just make it bearable. Because if it's bearable, I can get through it. Boy, when it gets unbearable, it's terrible. So just pray. If you want to pray, get a prayer card and say, God, let his pain be bearable. I'll be all right. Okay? And I'll pray for you. I have got a list. I pray every day. This gold marker I told you about, my daily, that's my proverb. And in that, this is the daily prayer list. And I've got one right there. And those two little initials, they start a link of 25 or 27 people that deal with affliction and pain every day. Oh my, it's horrible. And I pray for them every day. And I know, I hate to say this, but you know what I know? I know God's not going to take it away from them. Some of them think it is. Some of them think God is. Some of them know he's not. So I pray for every one of them, God, make it bearable. And so, guys, maybe that is your problem. Maybe it's going to be illness. Maybe it's going to be pain. Hey, maybe it's going to be discouragement. You ever been discouraged? Let me explain something again about this 20, 30-something generation. Let me help you guys, because they tell you guys this all the time. You have to have a dream. Kill the dream. You don't have to have a dream. Man, we have enough dreamers, don't we? Get this message. Get this message. Do you know what the difference is between a dreamer and a visionary? If a visionary's vision comes true, if he has this vision and he brings it to pass, others benefit. There was a man named Thomas Edison that had the vision of what? An electric light. And when he had his vision come to pass, have we not been blessed? You people have been blessed around this world who don't even know who Thomas Edison is. But they've been blessed because his vision came true. Two bicycle mechanics in Ohio had a vision that something heavier than air could fly. The Wright brothers. And their vision came to pass, and I will exploit that vision tomorrow, and some of you have too. Oh, I've never flown anywhere. You got something airmail. You sent something airmail. Yeah, we've all... When a vision, hey, somebody had a vision. My generation, there was a lot of kids had polio. Somebody had a vision. We can stop that disease. And that old guy, he came out with a vaccine, and it's just about been eradicated. He had a vision. When it came to pass, others benefited. Correct? That's the difference between a visionary and a dreamer. When a dreamer's dream comes true, it's usually they are the central figure. They're the heroic figure of their own movie. They rescue the baby from the car that's upside down in the lake. They stop the Muslim terrorist from killing somebody. They rescue somebody from a burning building, and everybody pats them on the back and tells them what a great person they are. And they dream it all their life, and it never happens. We don't need any more dreams, but boy, I know some people had dreams. I knew a young man, knew his dream was he's going to go to Hollywood and be a star. He did everything they told him, took acting lessons and dancing lessons, and went and got a portfolio of pictures made.
Yeah, that's what they do.
You know how far up into entertainment, the entertainment world he got? I don't know if you're aware of this, but you know, some of you people who are non-thinkers and you watch daytime television, you know, you watch those game shows. They don't let the camera catch a glimpse of them, but there's not two people there, there's three. You got these people up here who are participating in the game, and you got the audience. But between them and the audience, they got about three or four people down here, young guys, and they're cheerleaders. And they get the crowd to cheer when everybody, you ever hear the people in here all laugh at one time? It's not just a sign. These guys are trying to get people to laugh, and they're trying to get them. That's how far up into fame this kid made it. And then came home with AIDS and died. Let me tell you something, dreamer. Life is hard on dreams. Maybe you had a good dream. Maybe it was a sincere dream. But you aren't what you thought you were going to be. And now you look back at your life and you say, well, my life is a failure and I am discouraged. I am sorry for your discouragement. I am sorry. You say, yeah, but if I could have got this, I'm not a dreamer. I'm a visionary. If I could achieve this, others would have benefited. Well, it didn't happen. You know what you do? Endure it. Just endure it. Maybe it's grief. Let me tell you what my wife and I have never done. We have three boys. And we have never buried a child. Now, I thought about burying one of them. I have to admit. But, I know people. You know the toughest. I don't know how many funerals I've done. You know the most difficult funeral I did? Had one pallbearer who carried the casket like this for a six-month-old child. Man, you talk about take the breath out of your lungs. I understand why some people could say that I've never gotten over that. But you've got to get over it. You've heard this. It's not scripture, but it's still true. You ever hear time heals all wounds? Well, there, I add this to that, if you'll let it. Did you ever cut yourself? Isn't this true from the moment? You know, let me explain something. God made the body to heal itself. You probably never heard that before. And from the moment you cut yourself, doesn't your body begin to heal? And that healing process, it starts out this way. It bleeds. Then it stops. Then you got a scab. And then after a while, the scab peels off. Then you got this pink, fresh, new skin. And then even that disappears, unless it's a really bad scar. But in other words, basically that's it. And I always say, time heals all wounds if you let it. Could you imagine, you know, you meet somebody and they've got this, man, they got this really bad injury. And you go, what happened? Oh, look at this. I cut my hand. And look how bad it is. Yeah, when did you do that? That was 2005. Yeah, oh, look. Oh, wait. That looks like it's healing. There. Yeah, now it's bleeding again. So you have a grief, and you know what you do? Hey, I'm sorry. I'm sorry if one of your kinfolk died in a car wreck, but you don't have to put a cross alongside the road. You know what that's all about? That's all about trying to keep the sore open. Don't tell me I don't know what that's like, because every time I go to Ohio, I drive right past the spot where my brother died and went to hell. But we didn't put a cross there so that I can feel bad about it. I think about it every time, all right? But I'm telling you this, I am sorry for your grief. I'm sorry if your house burned. I'm sorry if something happened. I'm sorry if something happened in your marriage. I'm sorry if it happened in your family. I am sorry. But it happens, do you understand? And you know what you have to do? You have to endure it. Now, maybe it's not with you. Maybe it's not a sickness or illness. Maybe it's not pain. Maybe it's not discouragement. Maybe it's not grief. Sit tight. I got one for you. Age. Oh, man, it's coming. It is coming. I was talking to a pastor. I think I might have mentioned this to you. Maybe I didn't. Maybe I was talking to your pastor. But I was at this church, and this pastor said, pray for my wife. She's depressed this week. I said, why? He said, she's going to turn 40 this week. I said, oh. I said, tell her not to worry. I said, tell your wife that this week she'll turn 40, and then just 5 years from now, she'll turn 50. And then 2 years after that, she'll turn 60. And he looked at me. I said, oh, trust me, pal. It took me 40 years to get to 40. And when I got to 40, I know it could not have taken more than 5 years to get to 50. And when I got to 50, I mean, I remember blinking twice and I was 60. In fact, since I started this message, I think I just passed 70. And some of you believe that as long as I preach. But the fact is this, guys, I mean, man, there's, you know what old age is? Old age is getting pain where you didn't even know you had parts. Come on. You women, you know how you know old age? When putting the cereal back in the cupboard is a two-step process. Oh. Right? Did you ever do this? What is that? What do I have here that hurts? You know what I think this. I think all babies, when we're born, we all have pain glands. But they don't develop until you hit about 50 or 60. Okay? Let me tell all of the under 50-year-olds, listen, if you're under 50, get this message, okay? After you're 50, every night while you're asleep, your body tries to kill you. You wait. Here's the problem with that. It takes you a whole day to get over the trauma of that attempt on your life. And just when you do, you got to go back to bed. You know what my view of life is? My view of life, it's just another challenge. Yeah, called getting out of bed. Standing upright without, who spun the room? I'll tell you what my vision of life is. Life is a polished granite wall at a 45-degree angle, and today's goal is as to hook a fingernail as I slide toward the abyss. You say, wow, that's not exciting. I wasn't trying to be exciting. I'm trying to stay out of the abyss. And it happens, guys. You get old. I mean, you just get old. My wife and I, we're in good shape. We're surprisingly good shape. At least we tell ourselves that. But I finally told her, I said, babe, we're going to hit 70 one of these days, probably the day after tomorrow. And I said, we're going to hit 70. I said, we can't pretend after that. But the fact is this, guys, age will get you. Somewhere along the line, you're not going to remember anything. You know, I always tell people, we had this happen. I'm with this pastor. This was several years ago. Luke was still with us. So, it was, how long ago, baby? Who are you? You're kind of cute, I got to admit. Anyway, only Luke was with us. We were being very biblical, you could see. And we had this meeting with this older pastor and his wife. And we didn't have far to drive, so the morning we drove out of town, it was in Oregon, we had breakfast with him. So there's the five of us. It's this older pastor and his wife, then Kathy and I, who in our son's eyes are already 1,000, and then there's our kid. Did you ever do this? You're trying to remember somebody's name? You say, it's on the tip of my tongue. I said, well, stick out your tongue, I'll read it. And there was somebody that we all four knew. And you should have seen it. It was like the geriatric section. We're going, And the four of us, and Luke, you know, I see him slowly moving from one chair to the next. He's looking at us like he's the, you know, I'll put their bicycle helmets back on them, and I'll drive the van for them. And the four of us were like going for about 2 minutes, 3 minutes, trying to get, and we finally just looked at each other and started laughing. And you know how that is. You don't remember the name. And then about 2 o'clock in the morning, you sit bolt upright and say, Phil. And I get people, you know, and they'll forget something. I'll go, that's how it starts. So if you're starting to forget things, that's how it starts. Next step, just watch yourself. You'll start drooling just a little right here. And the next step is you'll find yourself sitting in a chair like this. And pal, it is over at that point. You know what I'm telling you guys? I am telling you that there's going to be afflictions. And you know what you got to do? You got to endure them. You're just going to have to keep on going. Now, I don't know if this could be possible, but there could be somebody that said this. You talked about endure hardness as a good soldier, endure persecution, endure sound doctrine, endure afflictions, and you haven't touched me yet. That's why I love this book. Look at chapter 2 and look at verse 10. Therefore, I endure all things. Isn't that nice? That's kind of that big broad blanket. Say, what's all things? Those are things that are unusual and unique and unforeseen that I did not mention in this message. But they're coming. Hey, you could have something happen in your life that I couldn't even conceive of. And you know what you're going to have to do? You're going to have to endure it. People quit because they can't endure. And I'm telling you guys, you know what this apostle said? He said, Tim, you're going to see some of the darkest days in your life still ahead of you. And I've tried to get you through some stuff, but I will not be there. Some of you, you girls, you ladies, maybe your mom is your best friend. I hope that's true. I was watching Sister Darling holding her daughter's hand walking out that church door today. Man, that's neat. Maybe some of you men, you're going to call your dad and say, hey, I need some help here. But then the day's going to come where you're going to say, I'm all by myself. How do I get through this? Endure. I'm telling you, the apostle told Timothy, if you can endure, you can get through this thing. You're going to have to endure. Let me tell you two stories and I'll be done. I'll give you another sidebar. I'm a car guy, and I had somebody say this. They said, oh, so you must like stock car racing. No. Isn't that where they go around in circles? I said, over 32 years, we have been going around in circles as fast as we can, just like them. And they're getting paid way more than we are. But I heard this, NASCAR, you know, they have all these races during the year, and at the end of the year, the guy that scores the most points ends up the NASCAR champ. You understand that? One year, the guy that was the NASCAR champ never won one race. Never won a race. He finished second, he finished third, he finished second, he finished fourth, he's finished second, third, second. He scored high enough that he actually outscored some guys that had beat him in a race. So what'd he do? He endured. If you thought, I'm never going to win a race, I may as well quit. No, never quit. Never quit. You got to endure. Let me tell you two stories and I'll be done. I was preaching in Norfolk, Virginia, very large naval base there several years ago, about 25 years ago. And there was a young sailor there. And he was on the USS Eisenhower. That is, I told you, that's an aircraft carrier, 5,000 people. You know what soldier or sailors do? They get in some country, they get leave, and they're in town, and they meet another soldier or sailor, and they go, "Wow, what ship are you on?" And they find out they're on their ship. My brother was on an aircraft carrier. He was on the FDR. It was about 3,000 people, and he would be in a restaurant someplace in Italy, and he'd meet another sailor and say, "Oh, what ship are you on?" "Well, I'm on the FDR." He goes, "I'm on the FDR." But this guy's in the engine room, and he was a fireman, and they never would see each other except on a leave. And so here's what happened, and they do this a lot. This is back in the days before the Soviet Union fell, and they take a 6-month Mediterranean cruise. So here that Eisenhower left Norfolk with a task force or with a group, and they had to go across the Atlantic. Now, the Atlantic is famous for its storms. And I don't know if you realize this, but they launch and recover planes in storms. You say, why? Because regardless of the funny joke, in case of war, in case of rain, the war will not be held in the auditorium. And so guys die in peacetime all the time. Somebody has something happen. I saw a video one time on an aircraft carrier where a guy walked too close to a jet engine and it sucked him right in. So the Eisenhower and its group, it made it all the way across the Atlantic into the Mediterranean with no accidents. Nobody got killed. Nobody got hurt. Trust me, that's a good deal. Now they got to spend 6 months cruising through the Mediterranean, keeping an eye on the Soviet Union. Now, here's what the Soviet Union would do. And I'm sure our guys did it with theirs. You got a destroyer. Now, think of an aircraft carrier as maneuvering kind of like, well, like my RV. I got a motorhome. And somebody said, how does it handle? And I said, you know, the handle of dynamics are not great when the words you use to describe it are plow and wallow. The steering wheel on an RV is not there to turn it. It is to kind of suggest a direction. You're in a lane and go, let's go over here. And it goes, okay. And so you got this thing that handles like that. That's called an aircraft carrier. Could you imagine a Corvette just going zip, 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 zip? That's a destroyer. And so the Soviet Union, they would send these destroyers right through our ships, and they would cut right across the bow, and sometimes they would hit. It doesn't matter if it's not the captain's fault. It is the captain's fault. And they played tag for 6 months. And while they're doing that, they're launching planes and recovering planes. Nobody got hurt. Nobody got killed. Didn't lose a plane. It was a flawless 6 months in the Med. Now they've got to sail back across the stormy Atlantic into Norfolk Harbor, back through the storm, sure enough, man, back in another storm, launching the planes, recovering planes in the night. You think about landing on an aircraft carrier, that is like landing on a postage stamp that's floating in the dark. And they can do it. But nobody died, and they didn't lose any planes, and they had no accidents, nobody got hurt. I mean, this is like, oh man, this is good news. And the ship is now coming down the channel, and it is 400 yards from where it's going to be berthed, where it's going to be pushed into dock and be at port. And 400 yards after a six-month cruise through the South Atlantic, storms there, the Soviet Union, the storms of the Med, another ship. Here comes the Eisenhower, and there was another ship at anchor. And as the Eisenhower is coming down the channel, this ship began to drift out into the channel. And as it drifted out, the very prow, just like the knife edge, the very tip of that ship, engaged the port side of the Eisenhower, raked the entire port side, did over $2 million worth of damage, and the captain lost his command. He said, that's not fair. Well, whose fault was it? Wasn't the cook. Wasn't your fault. Come on, who's in charge? You know what always amazes me? They try to tell pastors how to run a church. You know why they tell pastors how to run a church? Because if they're right, they'll take the credit for it, and if they're wrong, they'll blame the pastor. Now, I'll give you my other story. This was a story about a fellow by the name of James Nicholas Rowe. 2 days ago, I just heard that Jim Vineyard, the preacher, died. Just died yesterday, I think yesterday. Jim Vineyard was a Green Beret in the early 60s in Vietnam. And I asked him one time, do you know this guy? And he said, yeah, I do. And the guy that I'm talking about, it was also a Green Beret. His name was James Nicholas Rowe. And James Nicholas Rowe was a Green Beret, Special Forces, Army Special Forces, in Vietnam back in 1963. Now, back in 1963, they were indeed advisors. And what they'd do is they'd take four Green Berets and they'd give them a company. They'd assign them to a company of South Vietnamese Army soldiers. And you got Vietnam here. Look at my cuff. Okay, above here is North Vietnam. Below here is South Vietnam. And the South Vietnamese Army did not have one enemy. It had two. Sometimes the North Vietnamese Army, NVA, North Vietnamese Army, would cross into South Vietnam, and the South Vietnamese Army would engage them and have to drive them back. But back in 63, the biggest enemy they had were not North Vietnamese, but South Vietnamese who were communists, called Viet Cong. And so they would engage them. And late of 1963, the company, the South Vietnamese company that Rowe was with, was overrun by Viet Cong. And Rowe and three other Green Berets were captured. I think one of the guys was killed. So these three guys survived. And so they put him in a prison camp. Now, this is not a prison camp like you think. There's no barbed wire. There's no guard towers. They're not even being watched. You say, why didn't they leave? Because they're down in the very end of the Mekong River. In our country, the Mississippi Delta is famous, is it not? Does the Mississippi not come down as a river and it goes into Fingers and it puts all this silt out there? And down there in Louisiana, that's all swamps and alligators or crocodiles and snakes. Well, that's what the Mekong Delta is. And so they just had them down there in a camp. You say, why didn't they leave? Rowe left three times. He escaped three times. He couldn't find his way out. This guy is trained in jungle warfare and couldn't find his way out. He said the third time he escaped, he said he was so happy because he said, this time I made it. And he said, I thought I made it. He said, I parted these bushes and I stepped through, and there sitting around a campfire were a bunch of Viet Cong soldiers. Can you imagine? And he said, I had to think quick. So I went, hey, guys, I'm an American, and I was captured by the Viet Cong. And I was out gathering firewood, and I got lost. Could you guys help me find my way back? And they took him back. They didn't even know he escaped. Now, here's the problem. He didn't have to stay. Nobody had to stay. Now, when he was captured, here's what he said. I was not worried because the Viet Cong had captured three other Green Berets and kept them for 3 months, and then in a good faith gesture, returned them to the United States. So he said, I figured 3-6 months, they'll let us go. But he could go home the very next day, anytime. All they had to do was sign a letter. And all that letter said was, America is carrying on a criminal war against the people of Vietnam. I, James Nicholas Rowe, am a war criminal, and I apologize to people of Vietnam for what I'm doing. And they'd let him go. And they would let him go. You know what that guy said? The head of that camp, he said, and listen, don't think you'll go home when the war's over. We can keep you a long time after the war's over. So he said they did that, and he said what they would do is they would make them listen to Hanoi Han. Now, first thing he said is this. He said, when we were captured, we figured the U.S. Army would send in a rescue team and rescue us. And they never came. I mean, if you were in the Army, wouldn't you expect the Army to come and get your own? Wouldn't you kind of feel like the very Army I am a part of has kind of let me down, abandoned me? Yeah. And he said, then they made us listen to Hanoi Hannah. Hanoi Hannah was kind of like the Tokyo Rose of World War II. Hanoi Hannah was a Vietnamese, and she was a communist, and she would report all these things, propaganda against America. And he said they did that until 1967. He was captured in 63. And he said in 1967, they quit letting Hanoi Hannah went off the air, and they just reported all of the anti-American, anti-war protests going on college campuses in this country. And he thought, my army abandoned me. Now the country that I'm fighting for has also turned their back on me. That'd shake your faith, wouldn't it? Yeah. He said one of the greatest dangers. Now he said when he was first captured, he weighed 190 pounds. When he finally escaped, he weighed 120. Had a black fungus growing all over him. He said, I had dysentery for 5 years. And he said the greatest threat we had, he said they didn't torture us. He said if we were bad and they wanted to punish us, they just took away the mosquito netting for a few days. He said, I had 100 mosquito bites in 1 square inch of my arm. He said, I mean, it was torture. And he said, the worst thing that would happen to us is one of the guys, there were never more than about 3 or 4 Americans in this camp. And he said, what would happen is a guy would lose the will to live. And he said, when a guy lost the will to live, he just stopped living and died. He'd say, I'm never getting home. I'm never going to see America. I'll never see my family. I'll never see my kids. Never see my wife. And he said, when that happened, we would all get around him and we would boost him and encourage him. And we would say, no, listen, the war is going to be over someday. We are going to go home. You will see your children. You will hold your wife. You will have a car. You will have a job. You'll have another life. This will be over. This will be in your past someday. And if they could get it through to him that someday he'd get past this, he would come out of it and be okay. And if they couldn't get through to him, he'd just stop living. He died. So here he is. And then one day, they called the other three, there were four, they called the other three up to the headquarters of this camp and not Rowe. And they're up there a couple of hours, and then they called Rowe. And so Lieutenant Rowe walks in. Now look, he walks into a room where his three fellow prisoners are. And he says, hi guys. And they said, hi. And when he addressed his fellow prisoners, the head of the camp said, you can't talk to them anymore. He said, what do you mean I can't talk to them? The four of us are your prisoners. We live here together. What do you mean I can't talk to them? He said, no, you're the prisoner. They're going home tomorrow. They'd all signed the letter. They left the next day. You knew who came to get them? Tom Hayden. You know who Tom Hayden was? Tom Hayden was the open communist who married Hanoi Jane Fonda. They signed the letter. Now he's all by himself. But by that time, they had kind of figured out where they were. And they'd all made a pact. If one of us gets out under any circumstances, we'll call a rescue mission in. And the way the guys left behind would know the rescue was going to take place is they called an 01 bird dog, a little Cessna. It was a spotter. And he says, a light plane will fly over the camp and it'll cut the engine off and then back on, and then back off a second time, and then back on. And he said, when you hear a plane cut its engine twice, just get into the jungle. That's all you got to do. Just step out of the camp, go into the jungle. The Americans will come in, they'll bomb the camp, they'll bring in a helicopter, jump in a helicopter, we go home. He said, I waited for weeks. He said, no light planes? A lot of light planes. But nobody ever cut their engine. He said, the army had abandoned me. My own country had abandoned me. Now the very guys that I served in that camp with abandoned me. And he said, and then I lost the will to live. But there's nobody to boost him. He said, I had to lay in my bed and talk myself into staying alive. Now, can you see where this guy is? His country has turned his back on him. The army has turned his back on him. His fellow prisoners have turned their back on him. There's not, and now he is, tell me, is he not half a world away? He's away from home. He is there under protest. He does not want to be there. He wants to be home, does he not? And he's with a bunch of people that hate him. And he said, when I had nothing, when I had absolutely nothing left, I realized I had one thing. And he said, the only thing I had was my military code of conduct. Any of you guys that were in the military, there is a military code of conduct. And it is the basic code of how a soldier, sailor, marine, airman, or Coast Guard will behave. And he said, all I had left was my military code of conduct. And now tell me if this is not kind of a vague description, but isn't this an accurate description? Military code of conduct, isn't that a bunch of words on a piece of paper? Isn't it? And I thought, wait a minute. If I get this right, do you believe this? This world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. Are we here kind of under protest? Would you rather be home? And do the people that belong here not like you? And don't you have some words on a piece of paper? And when he said all I had left was my military code of conduct, I thought, yeah, that's what I got. I got some words on a piece of paper. And he said one of the things he was able to keep from the Vietnamese was that he could speak and understand and read Vietnamese. They didn't know that. And what he did is he was kind of like the good prisoner. He'd sweep floors through all of the buildings, including the headquarters, and he would just go through the desks or read what's on top of the desk. And he said, one day I'm in the office, and he said, the main office, main headquarters, and he said, I saw something on the head man's desk, and it chilled my blood. He said, I saw a piece of paper with my name on it. And the letterhead was the North Vietnamese Army, and I read it, and the North Vietnamese had said, send that guy to the North. And he knew, if they send me north, I'll never be heard from again. I will not get home. He said, I have got to escape. So he thought, I don't care matter what it takes. I got to get out of here. While he's thinking about how am I going to escape this fourth time, it is now, he was captured in 1963, but it is now 1968, 5 years to freedom. If you want to read the book, that's the title. James Nicholas Roe, 5 years to freedom. And he said, as I'm trying to think of some way to escape, he said, I woke up one day to the sound of 250 and 500-pound bombs being raining down on this camp. Because he said, now the Vietnam War is at its peak, and he said, the Americans are trying to destroy all of those Viet Cong camps in the Mekong Delta. He said, they bombed our camp. We had to abandon the camp and run for our lives. Now, you understand, this guy is now... he's now 120 pounds. He's wearing black pajamas like the enemy, and he's tanned. He looks just like them. And he said, for 3 days, we ran from the Americans as they tried to kill us. They bombed us. They strafed us. They shot. They did everything they could to try to kill us. And he said, we got into a field. Third day out, he said, we got into a field, and it was a field of elephant grass, grass about 7-8 feet tall. And I thought, and he said, there were two Huey helicopter gunships working that field. What they do is they fly over that field, and anytime they saw somebody move, they shoot him. And he thought, I have got to get myself away from these guys, and I got to signal that helicopter to get me out of here. Well, getting away from him was kind of easy. See, they're walking in file, and he's the next to the last guy. All the Viet Cong are walking ahead of him except his guard. And he said, I just started walking slower. I mean, everybody's watching the helicopters, so the guard doesn't notice that everybody's left them behind. And he said, so now it's just me and my guard. And he said, this one helicopter came kind of close, and the guard, he looked, and he said, while he was watching out, I picked up a tree limb, and he said, I laid him down, and he stayed down. He said, then I beat down about an 8-10-foot square of elephant grass. And he said, the next time a Huey flew over, he said, I stood in the middle of it, and I waved him. And he said, I looked eye to eye to the pilot. He saw me. And as he flew over, I saw him make the turn to do a 360-degree turn to come back and rescue me. He said, I am going home. But he could not hear what was going on inside that helicopter. And the co-pilot said to the pilot, there's another one. What do we do? And the pilot said, next pass, I'm going to gun him. They didn't know he was an American. They thought it was Viet Cong. They weren't coming back to rescue him. They're coming back to kill him. That pilot did a 360-degree turn, came back, lined up. Here's Roe watching this helicopter come, thinking it's going to take me back home. And the pilot is putting the crosshairs right on his chest. He flipped the button, put his hand on the trigger, and is about to kill this American. When orbiting 1,000 feet up in another helicopter was Lieutenant Colonel, who was the head over that whole operation. And when he heard the chatter on the radio, he said, don't shoot him, capture him, I want a prisoner to interrogate. That pilot pulled collective, that UE began to drop down. Before they ever got down all the way to the ground, one of the guys on the helicopter said, hey, that's an American. Roe says, they got down there, and he said, they grabbed me, and he said, they threw me onto the floor of that helicopter. He said, that helicopter pilot threw the kerosene to those two jet engines, and he said, I felt myself being lifted off the earth. I thought, yeah, I think that's what I'm waiting for. Aren't we waiting to be airlifted out? You know where we are right now? Right now, we are not home. We're in an environment that is hostile to us with people that don't like us, and all we've got is some words on a piece of paper, and we are waiting to be airlifted out, correct? He said, we get airborne, and the pilot turns around and said, who are you? Identify yourself. And he said, I am Lieutenant James Nicholas Roe, United States Army, Special Forces. He said, the pilot turned back around, got on the radio. He heard some chatter back and forth. The pilot, he said, he turned back at me, looked me in the eye and said, no, you're not. He said, I am Lieutenant James Nicholas Roe, United States Army Special Forces. He said, no, you're not. He said, I am Lieutenant James Nicholas Roe, United States Army Special Forces. He said, pilot said, no, you're not. You're Major James Nicholas Roe. He had been promoted from lieutenant to captain to major and didn't even know it just by staying in the Army. Anybody getting this? Just stay in, guys. He said, we landed at the base, and he said, I got off. And he said, man, did I stick out like a sore thumb? Because he said, here I am with the enemy's uniform on, the black pajamas, and I'm surrounded by a bunch of guys in Army uniforms. And one of these guys standing there said, this will never do. Disappeared in the crowd, came back with a brand new OD uniform. He said, I put it on right there. He said, there was a major in the crowd, took the clusters off his collars, pinned him right there. I thought, yeah. Yeah, if I got this right, after we get airlifted out, don't we get new robes of righteousness? We get some new clothes, don't we? He said, after that, they took me to the mess hall, and we ate. And he gave it a whole new reason to be called a mess hall. He said, you know what I'd had to eat that day? The day I was captured, the day I was rescued, he said, I had a half a cup of uncooked rice and a half a cup of rock salt. He said, I ate everything that wasn't nailed down. And I thought, yeah, if I get this right, after we get up there and we get these robes of righteousness, aren't we getting kind of a big marriage supper of the Lamb? And he said, I'm kind of equating this, you know, and he said, I'm in this infirmary because they're trying to get his health back to him. And he said, one day this really sharp lieutenant colonel comes in. He's got a little briefcase, you know, Army guy. And he sits me down at the table, and he identifies himself, and he opens up his briefcase, and he takes out a letter, and he turns it out to Roe, and he takes a pen, and he says, here you go, sign right there. And he said, Roe takes the pen, and he's about to sign this, and he says, what am I signing? He said, well, that's a waiver of your constitutional rights for your court-martial review. And he said, I stopped. I froze. He said, what? Now, I don't know if you guys realize this, but every POW,
when they are repatriated, has to stand before a court-martial review to see if, during their capture, at any point they violated that code of conduct. And I thought, isn't that amazing? He was the only American in that camp. He could have violated that code, and nobody'd know, and yet would have caught up with him right there. And I thought, what do we call that? We call that the judgment seat of Christ. You know what Rose said? He said, you don't understand. I could have come home any day I wanted to if I would have signed something that wasn't true. And I wouldn't do it for them. And I'm not doing it for you. And the colonel said, listen, trust me. It's a formality. You got to go through it. Just sign it. He said, no, get out of here. Colonel said, look, you're going to do this, Major. Just let me know. And Roe thought this. Now, guys, I'm going to tell you something. I've got to preempt what I'm going to say, because I never say this and people laugh. And this is nothing funny. He said he thought about, what if I sign that and I end up in Fort Leavenworth Military Prison? And he thought, if I end up in Fort Leavenworth Prison, I will have 3 meals a day and an indoor toilet. And he said, that's luxury living compared to what I've had for the last 5 years. And he called that colonel. He said, give me your paper. He took the paper. He signed it. They took him and stood him up before a board of commanding officers. He gave his story. When he was done, they said, no charges. But if at any point when he was here, when he was away from home, when he was amongst the enemy, if he had violated that code of conduct, it would have caught up with him right there, wouldn't it? You know what he was doing when I read the book? When I read the book, he was in charge of a program that the Army never, ever had until he was rescued. It's called SERE. It's something that all of them go through now, SEER. It's called Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, where all of our troops, all of our sailors, Marines, etc., airmen, they're all trained in how to endure captivity. We never had that. Roe instituted, designed, and ran that program. And I thought, he's ruling over his own part of the Army, isn't he? Here's what James Nicholas Roe said. The world doesn't care about the storms you've been through, but did you bring in the ship? You know what we've got, even in our churches? You know, we've got a bunch of violin players. No offense, Jonathan. You know, I don't play any musical instrument, but the fact is that I play the violin with the best of them. You ask somebody how you doing. Well, how am I doing? I'll tell you how I'm doing, and then they'll tell you and tell you and tell you. And we tell everybody our sad story. And we tell them why we can't read our Bible, and we tell them why we don't win souls, we tell them why we don't pass tracts, and why we don't tithe, and why we don't give, and why we don't live for God. You know what we don't do? We never bring in our ship. Well, yeah, but it was this terrible thing that happened in my life. I bet it was terrible. But you know what your problem was? You left it stop you. Rose said, the world does not care. See, you want everybody to care about the storms you've been through. The world does not care about the storms of life you've been through. But did you bring in the ship? And that captain of the Eisenhower got 400 yards away from bringing in his ship. But he was still far enough away they could still screw it up. Guys, we haven't brought our ships in yet. You understand? So, well, man, I don't want to mess up. What do I do? Endure. 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 That's how you get through it. I'd like you to stand with your heads bowed.